Tanisan and the Unnatural World. Because of her unwillingness to fit into the grand scheme of things, as clearly demonstrated by recent events at the top of the Tokyo Skytree, most of the rules that apply to the rest of us do not apply to Tanisan. You don't get anywhere in this universe by being cooperative, apart from a wooden box. She, on the other hand, had come to enjoy a uniquely Tanisan-esque type of freedom, only bound by what her personality would allow her to do and the limits of her imagination. So pretty much anything, then. The only problem was that it was starting to change things. Take the bees, for example. One bright morning, while washing up the breakfast things, she happened to hear a great deal of unnecessary buzzing going on outside her window, so she went into the garden to find out what was up with the local pollinators. What the little devils had done while she wasn't looking was to build a nest high up in the branches of the ginkgo tree. Tanisan wandered over to take a closer look, and as she stood there, gazing up into its leafy boughs, a splodge of something wet and sticky landed right on the end of her nose. She sniffed the suspicious substance and found that it was sweet, indicating to her that it had not come from something's bottom. So, with some hesitancy, she tested it with the tip of her tongue. Very Moorish, she purred, as the brown blob of what was in fact raw honey launched an all-out charm offensive on her defenceless taste buds. The question then for Tanisan was simple. How to get her hands on a very enormous quantity of it and not get stung? By far the best way was to get the bees to give it to her. But how? Perhaps if she knew a little bit more about them, she could use that information to her advantage. So she went onto the internet and began watching any bee-based wildlife clip she could lay her hands on. In one of them, Sir David Attenborough was introducing his audience to the giant Asiatic honeybee and, she noticed, managing to get very close to the hive without being attacked. Now, obviously, this was due in no small part to the protective suit that he was wearing. However, Tanisan also knew that as a wildlife champion, he'd often spoken up on behalf of the bee, and this, she felt, was reciprocated in their favourable attitude towards him. Like certain types of foreigner, she imagined, they were quick to take offence, but highly susceptible to flattery. It was then that she had a curious idea. Just as humans could not tell the difference between one bee and another, might it not also be the case that bees were unable to distinguish between one human and another? And if this were so, would it not be possible to impersonate the celebrated wildlife presenter without them realising it? The one thing that she had noticed was that Sir David favoured blue shirts. So, to add to the deception, she went into a drawer and dug out a light blue cardigan that her mother had given her, slipping it on over her smock. After that, she ventured out into the garden and made a big show of inspecting the area around the ginkgo tree. She said as she wandered about. Well, we can set the camera up here and the lights there, and if the hornets turn out to be as shiny as they seem to be, we can put the makeup department over there by the rockery. Now, it wasn't long before this behaviour attracted the attention of a passing bumblebee, who settled on a flower to watch her as she paced about, making all sorts of important decisions. Excuse me, he eventually asked. What are you doing? Tanisan glanced at him out of the corner of her eye. I'm making a wildlife documentary, she explained, pretending to check the light level on her smartphone. 15 milligrams, she read off. Perfect. Oh, can I be in it? Asked the bold little insect, fluttering his wings. I don't think that would be very appropriate, said Tanisan. The subject of the segment that we're filming today is the giant Japanese hornet. I don't suppose you've seen any buzzing about the place, have you? Thankfully not, said the bee, and fascinating is hardly the word that I would use to describe them. Tanisan peered at him. Well, what word would you use? She asked. The little bee seemed to give this his most serious consideration. Well, bastards is the term that most readily springs to mind. Horrible orange bastards. And the last thing you need in your nice nature film is your silky-voiced self having to say things like, take a look at this bunch of buzzing bastards. Not if you want to hold on to that all-important family audience. Now, in my view, you'd be much better off directing your efforts towards the humble bumblebee, which is a family-friendly animal. After all, you don't see giant carnivorous hornets adorning the walls of kindergartens and children's wards, do you? You see bees. Bees and butterflies. Thing is, I've done bees, said Tanisan. I've done ants, termites, and I've definitely done bees. As you would know if you'd ever watched my award-winning television series, Life in the Undergrowth. On hearing this, the little insect's mandibles almost hit the floor. You don't mean to say that you're... Yes, lied Tanisan, the very same. The little bee stepped back in surprise, almost falling off his pink petal. Oh, Sir David, I'm so sorry. I didn't recognise you. But of course, the blue shirts. Quite, said Tanisan, smoothing out the front of her mother's hand-me-down. I do like a blue shirt. It brings out the colour of my eyes, especially on television. Well, this is better than I could have hoped for, said the insect. Having someone as illustrious as Sir Attenborough to speak on our behalf would bring our plight to the forefront of public attention. Yes, well, I'll do what I can, of course, said Tanisan. But if it has anything to do with climate change, you'll just have to join the back of the queue. Oh, no, it's nothing like that, explained the insect. What then? Breath-holding competitions, said the bee. Tanisan was very surprised to hear this, but she kept her counsel. What she didn't want him to know was that it was she who'd come up with the idea of bees holding their breath in the first place, and now it was a real thing. I can't see the point of it myself, continued the bee, but many of our younger drones are absolutely obsessed with the idea of breath-holding. It's all they ever talk about. The trouble is, it's starting to have a negative effect on honey production. We're down by 33% compared to this time last year. So if you could have a word with them, Sir David, or better still, highlight the problem in one of your award-winning television series, you'd be doing us a favour. Tanisan rubbed her chin. She mused. Well, I suppose we could shell the hornet piece for the time being. We really shouldn't encourage them. Would you? Said the bee. That would be fantastic. And if there's anything we can do for you, just ask. This, of course, was the moment that Tanisan had been waiting for. Ah, now, it's a very interesting thing you've just said there, she jumped in, as if the idea had only just occurred to her. Is there anything you can do for me? Let me think. Well, yes, there is perhaps one tiny thing, although I wouldn't have mentioned it if you hadn't brought it up. I do like a spot of honey toast when I can get my hands on it. So if you could see your way clear to letting me have the odd dollop or two, I'd be much obliged. Nothing easier, said her bumblebee buddy. I'll put it to the Queen. So then, once they had royal approval, Tanisan and her apian chum made their way over to Majiro Teyan, a charming little city garden, not far from Tanisan's house, where there was to be a large meeting of breath-holders that very afternoon. By the time they got there, most of the contestants had already arrived. Wherever you looked, there were bees. Bees in the bushes, bees in the trees, bees buzzing about in a seemingly haphazard fashion, trying to find a good landing spot close to their friends. The regional quarter-finals, explained Tanisan's stripy companion as they made their way along the path past the koi pond. Now, I've had a word with the organisers, he buzzed, and they're happy for you to interview the current breath-holding champion, Hachinoyama. Just think of it, Sir David, he enthused. Your first ever interview with an actual animal. It was difficult to see how she could refuse if she ever wanted to see that honey toast. So she followed him through the spider lilies to a large purple bloom, where three bees were waiting for her, one noticeably larger than the other two. This was the reigning champion, Hachinoyama, who held the current breath-holding record of 7.86 seconds, which was pretty pathetic in Tanisan's opinion. He was accompanied by his manager, Max, and his trainer, Angelo, who was busy manipulating his front legs to relax his diaphragm. So, Hachi-san, she began, thrusting her smartphone into his face, are you confident about the outcome of today's bout? Yes, came the champion's gruff reply. And do you predict a victory in the early rounds? Yes. And do you think that you will smash your own breath-holding record, possibly by as much as several milliseconds? Yes. Here Tanis-Ann turned the camera on herself and gave an exasperated sigh, annoyed by the attitude of this so-called champion, who was saving his own breath by making her do all the work. "And tell me this, champ," she then went on, "are you aware of the recent scientific paper published by Wakeo University that claims that repeated breath-holding in bees deprives the body of oxygen, leading to chronic wing jam and a wonky endophallus?" "Yeah, what?" said Hachi-san, looking up in alarm. "It can also result in stage 3 Wallimarusis, reducing life expectancy by as much as 33%, she continued. "But then I'm sure your manager and trainer have already told you that." "No," said Hachi-san, gazing accusingly at the other two members of his team. "They bloody well haven't." There then followed a massive argument between Hachi-san and his support team, which in bee terms amounted to a lot of vibrating and waggling about. Now, as stupid as that sounds, it is in fact a highly effective means of communication. And soon the entire swarm was buzzing with the erroneous health claims put about by Tanis-Ann vis-à-vis breath-holding in bees. So when the reigning champion flew off in a huff, the rest of the contestants followed suit, and that was pretty much the end of breath-holding as a thing. In one fell swoop, Tanis-Ann had put a stop to it. Such was the gratitude of the wider bee community that for several weeks after that, all she had to do was to leave a little jar at the base of the ginkgo tree, and when she returned, it would be full of delicious honey for her breakfast. All the same, there were other, less desirable consequences. You see, news of her success within the bee community soon spread far and wide. So it wasn't long before other animals were seeking her advice, believing her to be Sir David Attenborough, the world-famous wildlife presenter. And with the bees still living on her very doorstep, she had no alternative but to play along with this illusion if she wanted to go on making regular withdrawals from the honey bank. Curiously enough, the only one that wasn't taken in by all this was William the stray cat. But then he was quite happy to sit there watching her dig herself into a hole. Until it began to impact on him directly, that is. You see, Tanis-Ann made the mistake of advising the mice in her neighbourhood on how to avoid the local cat population by rubbing themselves with citrus. So, as revenge, William decided to put an end to her meddling by enlisting the help of some of his distant cousins, who owed him a favour. And so it was that a few days later, she happened to glance out of her kitchen window, only to see a grumpy-looking cheetah sat in the middle of the garden, watching her as she did the dishes. How had a cheetah found its way to Ikebukuro from the torrid grasslands of Africa, I hear you ask? Well, if you're a regular follower of Tanis-Ann, which you clearly aren't, otherwise you wouldn't be asking such a stupid question, you would know that she had once discovered a cat map hidden behind a photograph in her living room. This map, drawn up by her grandmother, Tanis-Ann Senior Senior, gave her a unique insight into the secret paths of cats, paths that allowed them to go their own way, as is their wont, and to travel great distances in the blink of an eye, but only if they feel like it. However, what Tanis-Ann had been unaware of up to that point was that these cat paths were not solely a Japanese phenomenon. In fact, all the cat paths in one country were linked to all the cat paths in any other country, thanks to the efforts of every ship's cat that had sailed the seven seas, when it could be bothered to. And together, they formed a global network every bit as complex and as dangerous as the World Wide Web. Anyway, that was how the cheetah had ended up in Tanis-Ann's back garden. Why, I shall allow the cheetah to explain. "Oh, Sir Davis," it mewed plaintively, not even managing to get the name right, "you find me at a crossroads." "Oh dear," said Tanis-Ann, who was beginning to tire of this tedious caregiving role that she currently found herself lumbered with. "Well, you'd better tell me what the problem is, then." "Well, I hardly know where to start." "Well, my advice is this," said Tanis-Ann. "Start at the first capital letter and move slowly and steadily through the sentences until you reach the last full stop." "Wise words, I'm sure, Sir Davis," said the cheetah, "although I think it would be better if you saw the situation for yourself. Would you be so good as to accompany me to the Serengeti?" There was an awkward silence. "Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I had this morning earmarked for a trip to the Tobu department store," said Tanis-Ann, who was running dangerously low on cheesecake. However, she then happened to notice that all the bees in her garden had fallen silent and were listening to their conversation with great interest, the nosy little beggars. So for fear of losing her breakfast honey, she changed her tune. "Oh, very well, then," she said. "The Serengeti it is." Unlike her previous cat-map adventure, there was none of that frantic dashing about hither and thither, because she had put herself in the capable paws of the cheetah, who knew what he was doing. So within the space of a few seconds, they'd passed through Beijing, Tehran and Istanbul and were standing on a patch of parched grassland on the sun-baked savanna of eastern Africa. "If you'll follow me, Sir Davis," said the lithesome cat, making his indolent way across the plain, "I'd like you to meet Thompson, a friend of mine." Some distance ahead, there was a lonely acacia tree that stood out against the pale African sky like a wonky umbrella. Beneath it, a patch of shade. And in that shade, Tennis Anne could discern the form of another animal. As this was probably the friend that her spotty acquaintance had been referring to, she naturally assumed it was another cheetah. But not so, as it turned out. For what she was finally introduced to was a four-legged cappuccino of a thing, with pointed horns. "Sir Davis, Thompson the gazelle. Thompson, Sir Davis," said the cat, with a wave of his paw.
"Sir Davis Attenborough," said the star-struck herbivore, offering a hoof. "This is an honour, sir, and may I just say how much I enjoyed the Blue Planet, especially the sardines."
"Yes, sir, well, hearing you say that makes it all worthwhile," answered Tennis Anne, who was impatient to get on. "However, if we could cut to the chase," she said, "I'd be much obliged. I'd like to get back to Ikebukuro before the best slices are taken." Predator and prey shot each other a quizzical glance, confused by the cheesecake reference.
Yes, of course," said the cheetah. "Well, funnily enough, it's the chase we wanted to talk to you about, wasn't it, Thompson? It's this blasted evolutionary business, Sir Davis. It's driving us up the wall."
"How so?" asked Tennis Anne, shielding her eyes against the noonday sun.
"Well," said the gazelle, "put simply, it's like this. To avoid being eaten by my friend here, I have to be able to run faster than he does."
"And for me to be able to eat my good friend here," said the cheetah, "the ultimate symbol of life upon whom I and my kind so heavily depend."
"Oh, what a lovely thing to say about someone," interjected Thompson, touched by the sentiment.
"Not at all," purred the big cat. "Well, then I have to be able to run faster than he does."
"Which means that we're both caught up in a ridiculous race for speed," concluded the ungulate. "Speed and agility. And it's because we're both constantly trying to outrun each other that neither of us ever gets any closer to achieving his goal. All we're ever doing is running as fast as we can just to stay in the same spot, but with the added disadvantage of having to use up more and more energy to do so."
"So what we were rather hoping, Sir Davis," said the cheetah, "is that you'd be willing to oversee a carefully managed de-escalation in this sorry state of affairs, thereby allowing us to devote more of our time to the sorts of things that make life worthwhile. Learning a second language, for example."
"Or whitewater kayaking," added Thompson brightly.
So then Tennis Anne took a moment to consider their request, fanning herself with a piece of dead bark as she did so. "Well, I could give it a go," she shrugged. "How hard can it be?" "Very hard, as it turned out, but we'll come to that in a minute." In the meantime, Tennis Anne stripped down to her knickers and wrapped her smock around her head, fashioning it into a sort of headdress with a long flap down the back. She then asked the animals to demonstrate a typical hunt to her.
"Well, what I usually tend to do," explained the cheetah as he crept through the long grass, "is to crawl up on my prey slowly and stealthily like this. Then once I'm within striking distance, I pounce."
"I see," said Tennis Anne, nodding thoughtfully. "And what would you usually be doing at this point?" she then asked, turning to Thompson.
"Oh, well, I might be grazing here, or here, or over here," said the antelope, leaping lightly from one patch of dry grass to another. "But most of the time I would have already smelt him, no offence, and be halfway across the savannah by now."
"Hmm," mused Tennis Anne, looking from one to the other and then back again. "Well, I can't see anything wrong with the actual technique as such. So why don't we just try slowing things down a bit? Here's what I want you to do," she said, turning to the big cat. "Shout go when you leap out of the bushes, then count to 20 before giving chase." There was a confused silence. "Shout go, you say?" repeated the cheetah, clearly unconvinced. "Yes," said Tanisan, and counted 20. So they gave it a try. Their first attempt was an utter failure, because as soon as Thompson got the faintest whiff of the cheetah, he shot off like a rocket, clearly indicating to Tanisan that he hadn't quite grasped the nub of the idea. So she called him back and very patiently explained to him that there was no point in giving him a 20-second advantage if he wasn't going to meet them halfway. Not if he wanted to live the good life and ride those white water rapids. No, what he had to do was to play his part and slow down a little too. So they tried it again. And the same thing happened, with Thompson's fluffy rear end disappearing over the horizon before she could even shout stop.
Sorry, I keep forgetting, he apologised when she'd finally managed to call him back again.
To remind him on the next attempt, Tanisan grabbed two fruits from a nearby sausage tree and stuck them onto the ends of Thompson's horns, so that when he felt them wiggling about up there, he would remember to take his foot off the gas. Then they ran the experiment a third time, and the sausages did the trick, for Thompson checked himself and slowed down. But then the cheating cheetah, who'd only counted to 9, went tearing across the savannah and brought him crashing to the ground.
Hey, what are you doing? Called out Tanisan as she rushed over to intervene. You're suffocating him.
No, I'm not, said the big cat, who actually had to release his grip on Thompson's throat in order to be able to say this.
Yes, you are, said Tanisan, pointing at the poor antelope. Look at him, he's spluttering.
Oh, yes, all right, I am then, admitted the cheetah. Sorry, Sir Davis, I just couldn't help myself. I saw my chance and took it. Tanisan eyed him scornfully and adjusted her headdress. Then she looked towards the southern horizon, where dark storm clouds were beginning to gather. I think we need a quick break and a rethink, she said. Is there any way around here where we can cool off? There was, in fact, not all that far from there. So then they made their way across the plain towards a gentle rise, topped by some scrappy-looking trees and thorn bushes. As they crested the ridge, a little waterhole came into view, like a patch of sky on the ravaged earth, and with it being at the very height of the dry season, every type of animal you can imagine had gathered around its rocky periphery, regardless of size, temperament, and relative position on the menu. There were wild dogs beside warthogs, wildebeest next to hyenas, baboons and lizards in alarming juxtaposition to leopards, jackals and honey badgers.
"Be very careful here, Sir Davis," warned Thompson as they approached the water's edge. "It's not usual for predators and prey to find themselves in such close proximity, so everyone's a bit jumpy. Avoid any sudden moves."
"OK, I get it," said Tanisan, crouching by the water to dab her hot cheeks. "It's basically the United Nations, but with claws and fangs. You know, what you really need here," she suggested, "is a proper Japanese system with decent rules and procedures." On hearing this, an enormous bull elephant raised his trunk from the water and looked across at her.
"Who is this human, in absolutely enormous knickers, I might add, who thinks she knows so much about it?"
"That, my grey friend," bragged the cheetah, "is the world-famous wildlife presenter, Sir Davis Attenborough." At this, all heads turned in Tanisan's direction as she squatted by the water, performing her ablutions. First to speak was a rather weird-looking ostrich that had lost a lot of its feathers to stress.
"Oh, Sir Davis," it squawked, "can you tell those hyenas to find somewhere else to drink? They've been looking at us funny all day."
"That's not true. We always look like that," growled the shaggy-haired leader of the clan, in a thick Scottish accent for some reason. "And we've got just as much right to be here as you have."
There then came a great cacophony of growls and barks and howls and screeches, as each and every one of the animals, big or small, furred or feathered, voiced its individual satisfaction with the current drinking arrangements. In a funny sort of way, it reminded Tanisan of a situation that had once occurred in her own kitchen, when the household appliances had decided to play up for some reason. In that case, as in this, she was the only human present, so again she felt that it fell to her, as the most level-headed creature there, to act as mediator. So to get the animal's attention, she grabbed the largest rock that she could find, raised it high above her head, and brought it crashing down in front of her, sending a great spout of water squooshing up into the air. So much for avoiding sudden moves. "All right, listen to me, all of you," she said. "There's a very simple way of avoiding all this."
"Oh, and what's that?"
croaked a vulture that had its beady eye on one of the smaller baboons. "Alphabetical drinking zones," announced Tanisan emphatically. To demonstrate, she grabbed a bit of stick and drew two lines several metres apart in the soft mud at the water's edge. Between them she wrote the word "aardvarks" in large crooked letters. "You see this," she said. "From now on, this area is for aardvarks only, regardless of whether they're actually here or not. Which they don't seem to be at the present time," she said, looking around. "No one else is allowed to drink here. Instead, you each get a zone of your own. That way, there's no argument." So then all of the animals allowed themselves to be poked and prodded and pushed about by Tanisan until she had them nicely arranged around the waterhole in alphabetical order. But then, of course, it all fell apart when the local lions came ambling over the ridge. "Uh-oh," whispered one fault-finding giraffe to another. "There'll be some fun now. She's forgotten to leave a space between leopards and mongooses." As it turned out, though, this wasn't an issue, for the arrogant pride just barged its way to the front and began to drink. Once satiated, the mighty male raised his tousled head and looked about, only to find everybody looking at him. "What?" he growled. "We have a new system here now, thank you," said the elephant, who was one of the few animals that actually had the cojones to stand up to him. "Everyone who uses this waterhole has their own drinking zone, and they're supposed to stick to it." "Is that so?" said the big cat with the Tina Turner haircut, as he looked from one group of alphabetized animals to another. "And whose bright idea was that, may I ask?"
"Sir Davies's, actually,"
spoke up a lowly dung beetle, daring to poke his head up from behind his steaming breakfast. On hearing this, the Lion King turned to someone behind him, someone who was hidden from view by the rest of the pride. Having briefly consulted this mysterious individual, he then looked back at the other waterhole residents.
"My special adviser would like to know whether it's Sir David Attenborough you're talking about, and if so, would he be so good as to step forward and make himself known to us?"
Tanisan stepped forward and craned her neck, trying to get a glimpse of that elusive third party.
"So you're the one they call Sir David, are you?" remarked the King of the Beasts, quietly taking in her fabulous bloomers.
"I am," said Tanisan.
"Hmm," said the big cat, eyeing her dubiously. "Hold, please."
He then turned to have another word with his council.
"I've been advised to confirm that by carrying out a simple identity check," he then explained. "So I shall be asking you three questions." "Question one," he said, "what is your favourite animal apart from cats?"
"Oh," said Tanisan, rubbing her chin, "that's a tricky one. At a push, I suppose I'd have to say the Madagascan nunu. I don't know how they taste, of course, but they smell absolutely delicious."
"Nunu?" queried the lion, referring back to his grey eminence. "No, I haven't heard of it either. Is it a fish or something?"
"All right, move on. What next?"
"Okay, fine. Question two," he then put to her. "Of all the various wildlife documentaries that you have participated in over the years, which was the most enjoyable?"
"Hmm," pondered Tanisan. "Difficult to say."
"Not the cat ones, then?" inquired the Lion King, a little put out.
"Well, yes, of course, the cat ones," said Tanisan. "I was going to say the cat ones, but I took it as a given."
Somewhat mollified, her blonde inquisitor gazed at the other animals in triumph before moving on to his final question.
"Question three," he announced, "perhaps the most revealing question of all. When is your birthday, so-called Sir David?" Now it suddenly occurred to Tanisan that whoever was feeding him these questions probably knew the answer to that, even if she didn't. So all she could do then was to flush him out.
"I'd be happy to answer that," she said, "but before I do, I think it's only fair that your so-called adviser should show himself, just as I had to. Or perhaps he's too scared." This blatant provocation on her part appeared to do the trick, for there was a glint of cataract, a flash of grey fur, and William the Stray Cat emerged from the shadows.
"Of course," said Tanisan, regarding her furry feline frenemy from across the water. For a moment, the insufferable William just stood there, returning her gaze. Then, turning tail, he went padding up to the Lion King and whispered something into his ear.
"What's he saying now?" asked Tanisan, trying her hardest to listen in. "He's saying, get her," replied Aslan, who was, in fact, a bit on the slow side. "Oh, yes, get her!" he roared. At his command, the three fearsome lionesses that were with him jumped up and went charging round either side of the waterhole with a view to trapping Tanisan in a pincer movement. Yet all they managed to achieve in this case was to throw the rest of the waterhole residents into a complete panic, which was bad enough. But then, to make matters worse, the annual rains chose that precise moment to arrive. As the heavens opened and the lightning flashed, the little waterhole and its immediate environs were quickly reduced to a sea of mud by the constant trampling of paws and hooves back and forth. Anyone watching would have been treated to the sight of every species imaginable running about in all directions. And Tanisan was no exception. First, she ran from right to left. Then she ran from left to right. Then, as she was running from right to left again, she bumped into William, who came running the other way, just as panicked as all the rest of them. So she grabbed hold of his tail and held on tight, until finally he came to his senses and headed off down the nearest available cat path. Back through time and space they went, passing through Istanbul, Tehran and Beijing, until they finally ended up in her back garden. As soon as Tanisan let go of William's tail, he gave a yowl and shot off into the bushes, while she just lay there on the ground, panting. But then, after a moment or two, a little bee friend came buzzing over and settled on the end of her nose. "Oh, Sir David, what's wrong?" he inquired with evident concern. "You forgot to collect your breakfast, honey, this morning." "Keep it," said Tanisan, wiping the mud out of her eyes. "I'll be having cornflakes from now on."